listening to a podcast of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, which airs weekly in Burlington, Vermont on WOMMLP, The Radiator. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with journalist and nonfiction author Stephen Kirkjian, whose new book, Master Thieves, sheds light on the famous Gardner Museum heist, which happened 25 years ago this month. It is a case defined by superlatives, the largest art theft in history, carrying the world's largest reward offer, longer on the FBI's list of biggest unsolved art crimes than any other, save one. Two men disguised as Boston police officers trick their way into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum after midnight, tie up the two night watchmen, and make off with an estimated $500 million worth of artwork, including three works by Rembrandt and a Vermeer masterpiece. Now, 25 years after the theft, Stephen Kirkjian, who was the principal reporter on the case for the Boston Globe for years, has written a gripping account of the still unsolved heist of a quarter century ago. In Master Thieves, Kirkjian reveals how two criminal gangs, battling for control of the Boston underworld, knew of the museum's poor security and that one had a motive to pull off the theft, to fashion an exchange that would result in the release of its leader from federal prison. Stephen Kirkjian is one of the most acclaimed investigative reporters in the country. A 40-year veteran of the Boston Globe, he is the paper's former Washington bureau chief and a founding member of its investigative Spotlight team. Kirkjian has won more than 25 national and regional awards, including the Pulitzer Prize on three occasions. He's a graduate of Suffolk Law School and lives in Boston. During his career, Kirkjian specialized in writing about political and government corruption, as well as, in his later years, art theft. He has also written and spoken extensively about the Armenian Genocide. When I interviewed Stephen, I began by asking him how he first became involved in covering the Gardner heist.
It was 1997. I was out of state. I was in Washington when the theft happened, but I knew somebody who was associated for the museum with the case. So I read it pretty closely and I kept it in the back of my mind. And when I came back from Washington and doing my reporting down there for the Globe, I just kept it in mind. And then in 1997, the Herald got a big scoop and they got an individual who said he had access and could prove that he had access to at least one of the paintings.
Now that was Tom Mashberg?
Yeah. Tom Mashberg, and his source who said he could get him access to the paintings, or could get the feds the paintings back, was William Youngworth. Uh-huh. Youngworth is a fierce, is one adjective, but there are several others that I won't mention. But he's a fierce individual, and he wasn't about to come to the Globe. He wanted the Globe to send his son and wife down to visit him in a motel that he was staying at in Brooklyn. The Globe wouldn't go for that. So Tom had him alone, but the Globe was really feeling under the gun because this could be the big break. 7 years later, 1997, after the theft, that would lead to the recovery. And to put the ribbon on this package that Youngworth was saying, he brought Tom to a warehouse. Tom never said where, but in fact, Tom did say it was 45 minutes outside of Boston, which was wrong. It wasn't 45 minutes outside of Boston. It was in Brooklyn, New York. And Tom drove him down there. He got him access early in the morning to this warehouse, and he showed for maybe 10 seconds, 5 seconds, maybe just for a flick of a flashlight, onto a painting. Absolutely a painting, Tom says. There were strokes on the canvas. Mm-hmm. And there was a signature that, to Tom's best memory, was Rembrandt's signature. Mm-hmm. Now, Tom came back and reported, "We've seen it." This has remained one of the major mysteries of this case, because it's the only time that someone, to my estimation, is credible, has said that he saw something that resembled a missing piece from the Gardner Museum. And when I sat down with Tom, Tom was good enough to give me a 2 or 3 hour interview for my book on this. I was competing with Tom vehemently.
Right.
Tom came back and reported it, and the Globe threw me into it. And I just started to get, you know, become the sort of the lead reporter on the story. And I fell in love with it at that point. My dad was an artist. We talked about, he loved the Gardner Museum. I realized my two aunts had played a piano at the small concerts they had at the Gardner Museum. I went to high school right behind where the museum is on Palace Road in Boston in the Fens area. So I felt a sort of a connection to this story. And the longer I worked on it, the more I felt, you know, I could help. I could really help on this case.
Yeah.
So I would spend a lot of my free time working it. And I was able to convince the museum to give me access to their records on the investigation, asserting to them that this case needed publicity. And it wasn't enough for us to quote the FBI every year saying we're working hard on it.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have someone independent. They had to give someone a head start. And I got access to their, wasn't much, their investigative files of information, not that they had received from the FBI, but information they had received on their own.
Right.
And I, in 2000, and they also gave me access to the names of the two individuals who were working that night. And at up till then, we never had had a specific account as to how this how these errors had been made.
Right.
And, you know, the people who study the, or who are specialists in this field will tell you 80% of museum thefts involve an insider.
Yeah.
So I just felt, you know, let me have a chance to sit down and interview the both of the individuals who were working that night.
So their names were never released to the public?
They never had been released to the public,
oh.
Right? So I went to one fellow's house. He was the second guy on, and he wouldn't talk to me. He was afraid. He was still afraid. And so he wouldn't talk to me, and I never used his name. Then I went to the fellow who really was the one person in the driver's seat who made the two grief errors, one of letting them in, and second, stepping away from the only outside alarm that the museum had at the time. And when he stepped away from that, he was vulnerable, and he made the whole museum vulnerable.
Okay.
And
I have actually some questions about that.
Sure.
So first, I was wondering if you could describe the pieces that were stolen, like just the biggest ones.
Right. There are 13 pieces of art. Some are easily can be defined by the word masterpiece. And there are really three. Let's say four. there are two Rembrandts, his only seascape, Storm in the Sea of Galilee,
uh-huh.
A very big, probably the biggest of the paintings.
Right.
That hung in the Dutch room. A second Rembrandt, Lady and Gentleman in Black, sort of a stiff posed man and woman in the 16th century. For historical value and a very important painting, it's not exquisite like the Rembrandt, like the Sea of Galilee is. But the coup de grace, the most valuable painting was the Vermeer.
Yeah.
Vermeer's The Concert, one of only, let's say, 36 known Vermeers. The only Vermeer in New England. No other Vermeers in New England. The next closest one is at the museum, the Fine Arts Museum, in the Metropolitan Museum of Fine Arts. There's very few here in the United States. And this was an exquisite painting, probably one of the five most valuable paintings. There was another small sketch, postage size sketch of Rembrandt, a self-portrait that had been stolen before, I found, and returned. The only other theft that had ever taken place at the Gardner Museum since it had been established in 1903. But the other work, the fourth work that was third work, that the fourth work that was of great value, was a Manet portrait called Chez Tortoni. It's a valuable painting, but the most important part of its disappearance was that there was no footsteps that showed up on the motion detector machine inside the very small gallery that it was taken from. And it was, it's a, on the first floor, called the Blue Room. The Gardner Museum had very rudimentary security system. One piece of equipment they did have was a motion detector machine that that caught and recorded these footsteps of individuals inside the museum at night. Mm-hmm. It was turned on at night. And it was be looked at the next morning just to make sure that there weren't any the transcript would be looked at the next morning to just to make sure that the that people were where they said they were, and that there was nobody else in the museum, you know, except for the two night watchmen. There were no footsteps in the short gallery. There were no footsteps in the Blue Room.
Blue Room.
Yet. Yeah. The Manet portrait was taken from it, knocked out of the frame, and the frame itself was left on the chair of the security director of the museum. So another of an endless line of mysteries.
Okay.
There were in all 13 pieces. There were five Degas sketches. They seem to have spent the most time on a piece that they didn't get, and that was a banner up on the second floor in what is called the short gallery where they got the Degas, five Degas sketches. There was a Napoleonic banner in a frame, a wood and glass frame, but it, the wood frame was held together with six, let me say eight, two on each border, each side of the borders, eight very very small screws, and they worked mightily to get those screws out, and they got about four of them out, and they finally gave up. And in giving up, interestingly enough to me, they didn't break the glass. Huh. They broke the glass on other frames.
Yeah.
In the Dutch room where they stole the masterpieces, they it was shards of glass all over the floor because of the they had broken the glass on the two major Rembrandts that they had stolen. But they did not break that glass.
I wonder if they started with the banner and then got frustrated and started breaking glass after that.
And they, interestingly enough, right by the banner, on top of the banner is held in place by a flagpole, and on top of the flagpole there's a finial, and the finial is a golden eagle. They took that golden eagle, and when they stepped down from the perch, they had a table that they were stepping up. They were stepping onto to get access to the frame. When they stepped down from that perch, they were right beside the Degas. And I think that they were so angry, they shattered that Degas and they took the sketches. The sketches were of horse racing scene. Bad guys love horse racing.
Okay.
Let's say. So that I think that it may have appealed to them, or it may have appealed to someone to said get those, because the Degas sketches are not valuable.
And now,
compared to the other pieces.
Relatively, yeah. Now, when you say the bad guys, I wanted to ask you about the crime syndicate, the mob in Boston. How active a mob exists in Boston? Is this a pretty active crime network?
At the time, it was.
Yeah, and now?
Now it's much less of a presence here as in other cities.
Yeah.
It's not as controlling.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major reasons is because we've got a Massachusetts lottery.
Okay.
Quote, before the lottery, everyone, let's say, but, you know, a lot of regular, everyday people would go to their bookies to make. So bookmakers on the corner and in the bars was a network that was overseen by the bad guys.
Okay.
By the criminal syndicate. And so at this point in time, there was a very active network of criminal gangs. Two of the major ones were fighting for control. Yeah. What had happened, I say in the book, it's 85. It's really, I was told yesterday, 83. There was an indictment of the mob family that controlled the Boston underworld. Uh-huh. That was called the Angiulo family. They had been put in place and designated the controlling family, the control of the Boston, Boston area underworld by Raymond Patriarca, the godfather of all of New England. And they were indicted in 83, so they were taken down. They removed from the scene. Mm-hmm. It touched off a battle for control to replace them by two gangs. The designated leader was a gentleman named Frank Salemi. Tough guy, had major major criminal elements working with him and for him. And he was the designated leader.
Okay.
However, he was wrapped up in his own criminal case at the time. Mm-hmm. And a smaller, as tough, and younger upstart group led by three individuals, one named Vincent Ferrara, another named J.R. Russo, and the other last name of Sonny Mercurio. They started to intrude in and go to the, and what they did is they went to the bookies and they said, "You're not working for Salemi anymore. You give us the tribute." Mm-hmm. And whatever you're making in a week's time, we want 10%. That touched off a gang war between these two gangs, the Salemi gang and the Ferrara gang. If you were a member of a crime, if you're doing criminal work, racketeering, you had to choose up and decide which one you were going in. And then the two gangs started killing each other, started going after each other. And this happened throughout the late 80s into the early 90s.
And the general consensus is, like, your point of view and the FBI's point of view, although you don't agree necessarily, but there is definitely some mob involvement in the Gardner heist, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. If not the heist itself, the actual hiding and attempt to fence. Yeah. I think that that's the most logical. Mm-hmm. We may differ on who did what to whom at what point, but my independent reporting, and it was independent, I did not have any assistance from the FBI or the museum. It's very able investigators. They'll make statements when they have something, which they did in 2013.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't whisper in my ear, and nor do I know them whispering in anybody else's ears.
Yeah.
About where they are in their investigation.
Yeah.
But in 2013, I think in a very sort of bold and intelligent move, the FBI bureau chief here in Boston, in March 18th, in fact, 2013, then the 23rd anniversary, and said, "We know who did it. We know what happened to the paintings, and we believe we had what they call a confirmed sighting," which to me sounds like that they actually saw it. That's not at all what it is. It means someone whom they believe and is talking to them said they saw it.
Okay.
But there has never been anyone who has had a credible, concrete piece of information, evidence to show they have either a photograph or chips from the artwork.
Yeah.
So, but they said we had a confirmed sighting in Philadelphia, of all places, in 2002. Well, 2002 is a long time ago.
Yeah.
So if they haven't seen or heard anything since 2002, and they're not giving us any names, you know, I was one of two or three reporters working on the story, at least the press conference at the time, for the Globe. It sort of gave me a hint of a trail.
Right.
And it also gave, I was retired at the time, and I had 2 years before written out a proposal for a book. It flatlined in the publishing industry, but the reaction that FBI announcement got was so great.
Yeah.
Front pages throughout the country, throughout the world. Yeah. You know, we are about to solve. The FBI has given us, the public, indication they are about to solve the greatest art heist in world history. You know, this story is defined by superlatives.
Why did you say
this is larger than life? So I got a publisher, public affairs, an editor there came to me and said, "Would you be interested in, you know, in a modest advance and write the book?" And I had, you know, I had been on the story for so long. I said, "Let me wrap up what I have."
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I said, "Okay." So in 2013, early 2014, I began working it, and I did a lot of very hard original reporting on the clues that the FBI had left behind. The reason why I think that was a bold statement. The reason why it was intelligent.
Yeah.
Because the first time they had ever said anything about them knowing anything about the case. The reason was not to get closer to the mob or to give us to get us on the case. It was to arouse the public's interest in this case and in the missing paintings. Because if they hadn't seen hide or hair, and they'd worked hard on this trail since 2002, they hadn't seen anything, and they'd worked hard on the case, I think what they were looking to is calling out to the public, help us here.
Yeah.
Give us a lead. And what they said, they repeated it then, it's been stated at least since 2006, that there's a $5 million reward out there if you bring the paintings back. It's the biggest reward out there for anything, $5 million.
Right.
And second, we will not prosecute anyone for possession of stolen property. Understand, whoever holds that material right now is subject to arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment for possession of stolen property. They could go away for a long time.
Right.
So if they have it and are keeping it. So the incentives to assist in this were great. People who have followed this case know that those incentives have been in place for a long time. But the repeating of it got, I think, the FBI some tips.
Yeah.
Whether it led them anywhere, I don't know. But they did. They were pursuing very diligently this network that went theft from Boston, hiding and stashing it up in Maine for 10, 12 years, and then bringing it down to Connecticut to a bad guy there, and he stashing some of them. At least until now.
Yeah.
That's where they believe they went, to this fellow in Maine. This fellow in Connecticut. And I befriended him.
Now, one aspect of your book, Master Thieves, that I found really interesting was the gardener knew that their security system was flawed.
Yeah.
And there were mistakes made by various individuals, not just the guards. The board of directors was very concerned about budgeting for security, which
right.
would have cost them a lot less than $5 million. And, you know, the administration has been extremely passionate about recovering this
Absolutely.
Art. And,
and what happened was the night became day. You know, in September of 89, the prior director, who was overseen by a group of well-intentioned but not very active, dynamic Brahmin men, well-born, but were not like major contributors themselves,
mm-hmm.
and were not out there beating the bush for their, you know, and that's what you do when you're working for you're on the board of trustees for a nonprofit. You're on that board to raise money
right.
for the institution and to improve the institution and, you know, aggrandize that institution. They were not there. As one fellow who was on the board, a former Republican minority leader in the Massachusetts House, said, you know, I it was important for me to be on the board, but I wasn't going to, you know, I had fundraising to do for my Republican Party. I didn't have more fundraising to do for the Gardner Museum. They wanted me on the board for my name. I wanted to be on the board because I was very passionate about getting younger, disadvantaged kids into that museum, and they put that in place. Mm. And, you know, they may have used my name as we have Francis Hatch. We have Francis Hatch on the board, but I didn't. He said I didn't do much fundraising myself. I had my own fundraising needs for the Massachusetts Republican Party, which he ran for governor one year. Mm-hmm. And the others were of the like.
Yeah.
And at least the security director, as well as others inside the museum, would say, this museum is beginning to fray. We need an environmental control system that will take the humidity out of the air. The security director said many summer mornings he would come in and the paintings were sweating.
Oh my God.
Because of the humidity.
Right, you said that in the book. That's right.
And he would open the windows to get some fresh air in. So, and then he said, I knew we needed a better security system. My fear, he said, was it was a fire would be the big damage to our system. So I said to them, let's get a fire alarm system. Because they had smoke alarms.
Battery-powered
right. smoke alarms. And this is in the 80s. You know, this is not like in the 20s and 30s. So they said they couldn't do it immediately. They'd put it in a capital plan, but nobody was out with a big capital fundraising effort. But he said, so I did it. I made up my own stationery, and I raised $50,000, and I put in a fire alarm, very sophisticated fire alarm system, and that was in place the night and went off the night for still we'd have no reason to understand why it went off the night of the robbery. But as far as putting in the most important thing that was a need that everyone saw, including the security director, realized they needed what was called a control room. And what a control room is for any institution is a private room where all the intelligence, the communications, the security network comes together, and it's private.
Yeah.
It's not part of the public, you know, it's not in the public area. So it cannot be overpowered by someone who has a criminal mind. And the museum's control room was right in the public area where the security officer sat with the only outside alarm. That was their control room.
Yeah.
And anybody who went through it, including the security director himself, knew he had to get money for a control. But it was going to cost millions, and they just were not raising the money. And it's not they alone. I think my book talks about the increase in art in the 80s and value of art was astronomical.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, owning art was an important thing among the well-to-do. And the value increased immensely.
Now, did the I just was this just occurred to me, but did the theft bring attention to the Gardner that allowed them to fundraise better?
You know, 5 years ago, I was on a blog, and somebody asked me that question. Well, hasn't the museum benefited from this theft? You know, it's put themselves on the map, and you can think of that. But I think really it was the determination of Ann Hawley.
Right, right.
Was a force to be reckoned with. She was a force to be reckoned with on the investigation.
Yeah. She's retiring now.
She's retiring now, but she rolled up her sleeves on the investigation and worked it herself. She's been very, at times, frustrated with the FBI, at other times, not so. She's not outraged, not the right word, but just very concerned that it was not a high enough priority. She liked the FBI agent. There's been three who have worked in the case, but she never felt that the law enforcement community had the Gardner case front and center in their mind. Mm. And that is absolutely true. There were two major trials, two major investigations. that went into the criminal underworld in Boston during these years. The Gardner Museum never was raised with any of the witnesses, known witnesses.
Wow.
They never said to him, hey, what do you know about the Gardner? Help us out here. You know, if you could help us on the Gardner, we might be able to help you on a sentence.
Yeah.
That was never. And it haunted her.
Yeah.
In fact, she said in one of the interviews on her retirement, on her announcing her retirement, was that she said she had been haunted by the loss of these paintings.
Yeah.
And I think that's you can understand that. She'd only been on for 6 months when the theft took place.
Yeah.
She didn't you can't blame her. She didn't have time to get up to speed on all the needs of the museum.
Right, right. Now, I don't want to give away your conclusions in the book, but toward the end of the book, you do put forth a theory that you have based on some information.
One theory.
It came from some information from an anonymous source, and you tried to help the FBI by sharing some of the information that had come your way. So I wonder, without giving away too much, what came of that effort, trying to help them?
Well, what had happened was I had come to see that there was one criminal gang that the FBI was focused on, of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to learn more about the gang war that was going on. It seemed to be that they were focused on a segment of the Salemi gang,
mm-hmm.
Frank Salemi's gang. And I wanted to know, so I reached out, I got about three people who had been members of the Salemi gang to talk to me in this wing of the Salemi gang, to talk me about it. And they were pretty good. They didn't know anything about the theft. They couldn't tell me whether or not, but they were pretty good in telling me how it worked. So I wanted to get outside of the Salemi gang, so I went to the other gang, the Ferrara gang, and I wrote a letter to Vincent Ferrara. Vincent Ferrara had been indicted for racketeering he'd been arrested for racketeering, indicted in 1990, but arrested in November of 89. And I didn't drill down hard enough to realize the importance. Because what has always been missing from this case is a motive. Why would anyone, want to engineer or participate in such an incredible theft if you cannot sell the paintings? What is the value of it? Over the years, there had been known a misconception, but it's a perception among the bad guys, that if you can get a piece of art that the authorities want back, you can get a favor out of them. You can, in effect, make an exchange with them. You can get a lesser sentence. Maybe they'll let, somebody who's an associate of yours get into a better prison, into a less severe sentence. That never sort of, I had heard about that belief, but I never thought about it being involved here. But I knew that there was never a motive. Well, I reached out to Ferrara, and I got a call. Ferrara had been released from prison after he'd been arrested, indicted, pled guilty in 92, and had served until 2005. So he had served probably 16 years in prison on this racketeering charge. He had also been indicted and was going to serve another 7 or 8 years on a murder. He had pled guilty to this murder. In fact, it was shown that he alleged in court later that he had pled guilty only because if he had gone to trial on it, there was a possibility he'd be found guilty and he'd have to spend his life in jail. He had said from the outset, I was not involved in that murder. In 2003, they sought information from the prosecution on the murder charge, and they found the chief witness against him on the murder charge had recanted his testimony implicating Ferrara, and that information had never been turned over to the defense. Mm-hmm. When that was brought into court, Judge Mark Wolfe, you know, a man with a lot of rectitude in the Boston on the Boston federal bench, released him. He released Ferraro. And Ferraro went back, and he released him with sort of glowing terms. He said whatever criminal involvement he's had in the past, he has had nothing, no indication of any criminal involvement while in prison. So I'm releasing this man because I think he's an honest man and he's a man of value. And he did. He released him. So Ferraro just sort of went back into the woodwork and was never, no allegation of him ever being involved in any other crime once he was released in 2005. So someone had said to me last year around this time, 2014, Ferraro's trying to figure out the Gardner Museum. Well, there's a $5 million reward, so you can understand why. So I wrote to him, and I heard back on a Saturday night as I'm finishing up writing the chapter on the heist itself. I get a call from someone who says to me, I want to talk to you about your letter to Vinnie Ferraro. Well, what's your theory of it? And I said, well, I don't really have a theory, but let me tell you what the FBI says. And I told him about the Salemi gang and why the FBI, and he says, that's not it. He says the theft was done to get Vinnie out of jail. Huh. And all of a sudden, it's, wow, at least the timing is right.
Right.
So I said, tell me more, please. He gave me an outline of it, and then I met with him for over a week's time, sat down with him so I could look him in the eye. He knew Ferraro's story.
So this is an anonymous source who's...
I cannot say who it is, but
right.
He knows, knew Ferraro's story.
Okay. Yeah.
So I said to him, okay, I'll try the best I can to confirm it. And he told me, Ferraro's second in command, a guy named Robert Donati, in fact, was Ferraro's driver, chauffeur, you know, and had been his blood brother in a criminal gang, in Ferraro's criminal gang, had said to him, we're going to get you out of jail. This is how we're going to do it. Didn't tell him when he first told him when he came to visit him in 89, but after the Gardner theft, came back to him and said, we did it, we're burying the stuff, we're going to let things settle down, and then we'll begin our negotiations to get you out of jail. The person who knows Ferraro's story said to me that Ferraro said to him, don't do it, no one's getting me out of jail. I'm here for racketeering. They're not letting any alleged mafia leader out of jail. You know, whatever you've done, but don't get me involved. So nothing was heard of again, and then Donati was killed about a year later, brutally assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
By whom, never been clear. Mm-hmm. But that story, now, did Bobby Donati pull off the Gardner Museum heist? According to this person, he told Ferraro he was going to do it. He had the motive to do it. There are two other pieces of the clue of the puzzle that I found compelling. One is that Miles Connor, who was a legendary art thief, antiques, art, whenever there's anything stolen in New England that's of value, Miles's name would have come up with it. Miles wrote a book called The Art of the Heist, in which he talks about thefts that he pulled off. He talks about a case that a theft he pulled off in the mid-70s involved, you know, the theft was pulled off. It was from up in Maine, the Woolworth estate in Monmouth, Maine. They stole several Wyeth paintings out of this home. His associate, he says in Miles's book, Miles says his associate on that theft was Robert Donati.
Mm.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. The second interesting thing, though, is that Miles got caught in trying to fence the artwork. He never gave up Donati. Donati was never charged on that. So we don't know if it was he. We only have Miles say it. He was with me on that score. When Miles got caught, his lawyer in the mid-70s was a very able criminal defense lawyer in Boston named Martin Leppo. Martin Leppo made it, and Martin Leppo, Miles was going to go to jail for a long time, mm-hmm. 8-10 years on this main theft that he had tried to fence the Wyeth paintings on. All of a sudden, there's a theft of a Rembrandt from the MFA. It's taken at gunpoint. They run out, they put it in the car, and they take off. Miles tells the authorities, I can affect the return of that Rembrandt. You've already got the Wyeths that I stole. I'll affect the return of that Rembrandt if you give me a break on the sentencing. And they did. The break was, I don't know what the federal judge was going to, I think that he got 8 years and he served 4 or 5. But they made the theft from the MFA that time served at the same point, at the same, during that same period that he was serving his time for the main robbery. So right. It was a here I am a lawyer and I'm forgetting the term, but the it's continuous. This yeah. The term was it was continuous, so right. That he did not have to serve an extra time. He was ready to acknowledge, I have access to that Rembrandt. I engineered that theft. I will get it back to you, but just give me a break on this
on your sentence,
main
yeah.
case. And they yeah. did. Not a big break, but they gave him a break. But out of that theft and out of that arrangement has come this illusion among the bad guys. And the more I talk to them, the more I realize they're involved in a different world than we are.
Yeah.
And you cannot use common sense and logic and data with them. They
yeah.
have what they have, and that is their fierce belief that the feds will let you out of jail, give you amazing break if you bring back a piece of artwork. So here it seemed to me that if Donati was involved in the main case, he would be very knowledgeable of the break that his cohort on the case, Miles Connor, would have gotten from the feds, and he would have realized
right.
once his second in command, once his leader was arrested for racketeering, the only way that he could affect the release of his leader, and it wasn't just because of his leader that he was, you know, he was feeling sympathetic. It wasn't just that he felt he was vulnerable.
Right.
You know, Donati himself was vulnerable.
Right.
And it was
so
true. He was vulnerable. He was dead in a year.
So you brought these lines of thinking to the FBI.
Yeah, I brought it to the FBI.
And
they were good. And, you know, they took notes. Jeff Kelly and Anthony Amore. You know, of course I thought, you know, we'll work out an arrangement. If this leads to something. My only request was, and it was taken into account, was if this does lead to a search party, let the Globe come along. I'm not working for the Globe. I was working on my book, but if this was going to happen, I couldn't save it for the book. If they were going to find something, God,
sure.
Eureka. And they said it was, that there was a legitimate, at least Kelly said it was a legitimate request, but the FBI then said, no. If we do anything with this, we'll let you know what happened, but we're not letting you come along with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't.
Okay.
It's called a ride along, and they don't do ride alongs anymore. But it seemed to me, I'm the reporter. I'm very aware and able in what I do. I present
right.
myself to people. I tell them why it's in my best interest, why it's in their, and why it's in the public's best interest that they assist me with this piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And why they won't get hurt if they assist me in that piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, I try to go to their better sides.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It worked a lot in this book,
okay.
in this research. And I
yeah.
think the reason why is because of the higher goal, forget the $5 million reward, is of getting that artwork back
yeah.
to the museum so it can be viewed again. Like Ann Hawley says, it's an unheard symphony. It's an
yeah.
unheard play to have that missing. So
now, You know more about this than most people. I'd say you probably know as much as the 10 people who know the most. So do you think this artwork will be returned in coming years?
Yeah, I do. And I think it'll happen in one of two ways. You know, the FBI, Jeff Kelly, the individual agents, Anthony Amore, people like myself, other reporters, have worked very diligently, knocked on every door. You know, they've made the best case possible, and it hasn't produced a eureka, I'll call it the eureka moment. So what I thought about this, and a couple of years ago I had been talking because another FBI agent had written a book about art theft, and he had worked with a French art detective in Paris, France on a case, and it was an interesting account of the case. So I talked to the French detective, and I said, well, tell me, what do you know about the gardener? He said, well, I only know from what I read about it, but he said, our big case like that was a theft from an Impressionist museum here in Paris. And I got to tell you, the pressure on us to solve that case was intense. Mm. It all the time, we felt it from the public, and we felt it from the political structure, hierarchy. This was a shame on us that this had happened and continued. He said, I don't see that happening here. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are you saying? He said, has anybody ever said anything beyond the museum? And I said, you know, that is remarkable. No one has ever spoken about this loss. And let's not call it the crime that we're talking about, just the loss.
Yeah.
And I started to think about that, and as I wrote the book, more and more I thought, you know, the Boston has gone through an incredible testing, you know, of a challenge through the marathon bombing.
Yeah.
And my friends at the Globe wrote a book about it, and I, you know, my family comes from Watertown, where they caught the Sarnaeus. The one South Africa was on trial today. And I sort of think about the city. You know, I feel very, I'm a Boston boy. I feel that the city has changed incredibly during my lifetime, just in the slackening of the tribalism, the importance of diversity for all of us. You know, the city has changed its complexion and has changed its how it gets along with each other over the years to that day of that bombing, and it recovered. 260 people injured, taken to the hospital. Not one of them died at a hospital. You know, the only ones who died were those affected by the blast and the police officer. So and that led in this sense of, you know, we can come back from this. And you feel it when you walk around the city, and I do walk around the city. And I do a lot of writing at the Boston Public Library. You know, I don't know all the Pauls, but I do think I have a feel, for having worked at the Globe for so many years, a sense of, you know, this city is on recovery, and it's come back. And I do think, not just because of the recovery from the marathon bombing, but it has become a world-class city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now aspires to be an Olympian city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yet, and I, as I say in the book, you stand in front of the Boston Public Library, the center of intellectual, of education, of achievement, and you see one statue for artistic achievement, and it has eight names listed, from BC times to to Rembrandt. So, and six of those painters have their works at the Gardner Museum. Nowhere else in Boston do you have six of those eight. Yet the Gardner Museum is known for the loss.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Even though it's recovered, it's self-recovered.
Yeah.
It's still known for those 13 paintings that are missing. So I said, there's got to be some feeling, because I felt this is like a cold case now. Like you say, you know, people don't know about this. Yet, we lost. This is the biggest art theft, but forget in dollars. It's just the only Vermeer we had in New England, the only Rembrandt seascape. It's missing. And it's ours. It's not the museums. It's ours.
Right.
It's cities.
Right, right.
And that sense of loss, I think, has to be presented in some magnified way to the public. And that's when I came up with this idea that I speak about a lot is about the feeling of collective loss. And I think if the leaders of our community, whether they're academic, artistic, government, religious, and even sports, stand in front of those paintings, of those empty frames, and say, Boston, we're not going to be an Olympian city until we get this artistic work back. That feeling of loss has to be emphasized to the public. And I think with that feeling of loss, those very few people who know something, and just they just feel there's nothing in it for them. They're not going to shake the rug. They're not going to disturb the status quo. That they would be challenged,
right?
To say, call the FBI. You can do it on the QT. If you want the money, you can get the money. No one's going to be exposed here. Just help us get that artwork back. I do believe the people who stole it are dead. They're in a dangerous field. There's a gang war that was going on. For whatever reason, there were a lot of gangsters in the various gangs who were killed during that period between 88 and 93, 94. My sense is whoever was involved in here is dead, because if you had known access to the paintings, there's no reason for you not to give them back.
Right, right.
And get them back. So my sense is, logically, is that they're dead. And in a gang, the only people who know about individual scores are the individuals who are involved in the score. If you're in a 10-person gang and you do something with one of the 10, it's only you and that other person and the boss of the gang who know who actually did it.
Yeah.
So it's not a shared information.
So that's excellent. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you very much, Sheila. Can I just underline one thing?
Absolutely.
And that is the how privileged I feel to have worked as a reporter for the Globe and on a story that, you know, quote, at the end of my career, unquote, that really has a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, some of my friends, boy, Steve, you've been on this one a long time. I think you're obsessed by it. I don't think I'm obsessed by it. I do think about it a lot, but I do think it has a higher purpose.
Yeah.
And to get that artwork back. So I am, I'm hopeful. I absolutely am hopeful. One way is this public appeal to get people talking about it and maybe stir the conscience of those one or two or three who may know something or suspect something.
Right.
The second way is if someone does have them, they'll decide to move one or two of the pieces and their headlight will be out. And the FBI or the police pull them over and open up the trunk, and they'll find them.
Yeah.
One of the ways.
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome. Well, thank you very much for reading the book and for the interview.
This was a wonderful book, a wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stephen Kirkjian. You can learn more about his work and the Gardner Museum heist at his website, stephenkirkjian.com, and that's spelled STEPHENKURKJIAN, stephenkirkjian.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space, as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999 or mainstreetlanding.com for more information. And by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, jerry bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. I'm going to write a longer version of this week's Write the Book prompt on the podcast site within the next few days. For now, know that it will be about suspense in nonfiction. Check it out later this week at writethebook.podbean.com. And then good luck with it, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And on that website, you can also read about my novel, Shape of the Sky. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then finally, please remember that The Radiator is in the community thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been a podcast version of Write the Book, which airs weekly on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening.